Welcome to Great Photography. This is Daniel. In today's episode, I will have a conversation with Alex Burke. Alex is a landscape photographer based in Colorado. I'm citing the following from his website, and I quote, "The emotional connection we all have with nature is powerful. Nature can be intense and unforgiving, as well as calming and peaceful. I seek out remote locations where these true feelings of the natural world can emerge, using photography as a means to capture these emotions and bring them back for all to see," end quote. I encourage you to check out Alex's stunning work on his website as well as on his Instagram, and we'll link to that in the show notes. So let's get started. All right, Alex, welcome to Create Photography. I'm very excited about speaking with you today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'd like to start with your beginnings in photography. And I'd be just curious how you started in photography.
Really it started, I grew up in a mountain town, Estes Park, Colorado. And, my family, we went for hikes and stuff like that. I don't think I really connected with it too much, though, until I left that small town and moved to Phoenix, a city with 5 million people, coming from a town of 5,000. It was a huge change. And really what happened was I just wanted to get out of the city. So I would just drive out into the desert where it was just quiet and you could just hear nothing but your ears ringing from the true silence at night out there. And, I'd be out there for sunset or maybe a sunrise or something like that. And I just kind of wanted to capture it. So I just kind of had my dad had some like garbage 1-megapixel camera he sent me. I don't know why he even had it. He sent that to me and I'm like, oh, I'll just take some photos with this. And, so I just kind of messed around with that. It was just a reason to get outside to push me out there. And then from there, I couldn't really afford a nice digital camera. So I got a film camera and then just kind of went from there at that point.
And have you always been focusing on landscape photography? Was that always kind of like your passion?
Yeah, I think like super early on, you kind of mess around with, a few other things, just seeing what you like in photography. But right away, I knew it was the reason to get outside. And then it became like the reason to go for a longer hike, the reason to start backpacking, the reason to take big, long road trips across the country was all photography.
Yep. Now, I understand you live in Greeley, Colorado.
Yep.
And I had to look it up, admittingly, but it is
I don't blame you.
North of Denver. And what's interesting about, what you describe on your website, it gives you obviously access to the beautiful Colorado mountains, but also the less photographed Eastern Plains.
And yes.
I'd love to talk a little bit about that first.
Right.
So what fascinates you about those plains?
Yeah, and that kind of started, I started photographing the plains because I lived in them, really, not every day do you have time to go, drive the hour and change to the mountains, I'd see something interesting or there'd maybe be cool weather or something happening and I'd go 15, 20 minutes away from the house and, just see some cool, it'd be the time where I would start to put man-made elements into the images. So I'd see a stack of hay bales or a barn or something like that, something that just caught my eye. And I would just kind of work with that plus the interesting weather conditions. It'd just be a reason to shoot something. And then I actually really started liking it. I'd go a little further out from town where there's truly nothing on the horizon except for maybe one structure. So I can get these really minimal compositions. And I just started chasing that more and more. It's kind of become my favorite landscape to photograph.
So yeah, and kind of what you already kind of repeating what you just said. So you obviously have a beautiful portfolio of images that show nature that is untouched, mostly, right? But then in the Eastern Plains now you added structures to it, which I think is also, I really actually love that too, because it's obviously also the reality of our world today, so that there's
absolutely
probably there aren't a lot of spots that are untouched. But I want to talk a little bit more about that, kind of like what excites you about kind of adding those elements, I guess, to your photography.
Yeah, you know, and even I think when I was first trying to photograph near home, I'd still try to leave out that man-made stuff. You know, I'm a nature photographer. I really want to keep it, you know, as wild and untouched looking as possible. Right. And I realized that wasn't a possibility, especially I'd say the time that I was really trying to photograph more around home was in 2010. I started really pushing around here more. And there was this giant oil boom in the industry, oil and natural gas. Yeah. And I mean, it was huge. They were fracking everywhere. I got to this point where I realized there was nowhere in my county where I could stand and not see a sign of the oil industry, a flaring tower, a drilling rig, pumps, pipes, you know, barrels, whatever. There'd be something and I'm like, well, that's my subject right there. I mean, it's all there is. So what else am I trying to photograph? So I actually really started doing this kind of interesting series on the oil industry, kind of just the way I saw it juxtaposed with the landscape there, kind of starkly standing out from it. That kind of became my main subject for a while. And then I kind of moved into the other man-made structures and really just kind of letting that be the time where I show how man has, you know, affected the landscape, whether it's good or bad. It's kind of up to the viewer to decide.
And how is it now with the, is the oil, is that still an ongoing topic, or has that died down, or
interestingly enough, it's kind of calmed down. There were some regulations did come in, and you know, they had to put up big sound barriers, which actually made them much less of a photographically interesting subject, but also they just stopped drilling a lot less. Prices crashed in, you know, what, probably 2015-16 or so. Prices really dropped, and there wasn't really the reason to drill as hard as they had, and there was other reasons why they really boomed really early on. In fact, even around town, they've removed some structures as they've tried to build more subdivisions. We have actually quite a population boom going on. So there's actually less signs of the oil industry now than there was. There's more permanent infrastructure, a little more of the pipeline, stuff like that, but less drilling, less, you know, just machinery way out there on the prairie.
So is it also then less of a political issue, or do you think that's still, is it still something that
I don't remember, you know, this last has been a lot less oil and natural gas type regulation on our ballots in the last couple of elections. Was kind of things they were, you know, there have been concerns. I mean, this stuff does occasionally explode or anything, right? You know, there's or health risks and such like that. So I would say that there have been some changes as far as that goes a little bit.
And you alluded to that a little bit, but I noticed you, so you really do have a whole series on the oil equipment and the machinery in the landscape on your website, right?
Yeah. It's just under the oil section. Yeah.
So going back to some of your images. So one of the things I noticed, you know, when I look on the website or Instagram, wherever, but even, you know, if you look at it on a bigger monitor, it's just, they have the images have an incredible clarity to them. And so can you maybe just kind of explain, how do you achieve this, maybe artistically and or technically?
I mean, a big factor in that is the large format film. I'm just using, it's 4x5 inches of film, which is just way bigger than most people are shooting when it comes to either a digital format or a smaller film format. So there's inherently just going to be a ton of detail in that. When I scan these sheets of film in, I get a 1.7 gigabyte file, you know, so there's this endless detail to work with, a ton of sharpness and clarity. And then clean compositions, I think, kind of add to that effect, too. So you can see, especially when working on the prairie, they're pretty minimal compositions. There's just kind of one object, a flat horizon, a lot of emptiness. And I think that kind of really makes the subject pop out.
Right. So, you know, while many people might argue, right, that cameras are just a tool, obviously in for your photography, clearly the large format, you know, enables you to kind of translate your vision creatively. And I do understand, right, that the process of photographing with large cameras can be maybe a little daunting for those who might start out. And you're obviously now, by now, very, you know, very experienced. I mean, I've seen actually he had a blog post and photographs on the lunar eclipse, which is, you know, it's mind-boggling to me how you accomplished that on film, and really beautiful. But so this is kind of a long-winded way to get to my question, but were there ever times, you know, you've been in the large format, my understanding is for quite a while. Were there ever times where you're thinking about, you know, maybe I should go digital? I mean, the digital sensors are getting more detailed. You know, there's medium format, digital cameras, et cetera, et cetera. Or is that, do you feel like, you know, that's just the medium for you and that's kind of where you're going to keep going?
Yeah, actually, really the only time I ever considered going digital was quite early on. It was when I was shooting 35 millimeter film, and I just wasn't, you know, this would have been, I think, over 15 years ago or so.
Okay.
And I was a little, you know, you just can't make very good large prints for like landscape type imagery from 35 millimeter. And I was like, you know, I really do want something better. So I was considering either at that point going with digital, which you can certainly get much better prints than 35 millimeter from, or just sticking with film, which I love, and just making it much bigger. And I pretty quickly was like, you know, I really do love the look of slides. I hadn't shot much negatives at that point. I came to love those later, but I love the looks of slides in a light table. And I'm like, just make that bigger. And I never looked back after that. I've never even really considered switching to digital. I think that maybe even some of the modern medium format stuff in certain senses may be sharper than a large format image. Certainly, you know, you could probably work with wind a little more easily. There's all sorts of things you could do. Yep. Just love this format. It works well with my flow. I don't see any reason to change that. And I love that I don't really have to upgrade or change gear. You know, just the stuff works. It's simple. It doesn't have any batteries. So I just love it.
Right. You're photographing a lot of color, right? And you said color negative film and slide film. And then you do some black and white, I believe, but
not for a while. Yeah.
Not for a while. Okay. So it's still mostly color. Do you develop, I know you scan it yourself, right? But do you also, do you develop it yourself as well?
Yeah. I have a Jobo rotary processor. I'll actually be developing a little bit more of my Alaska film after this podcast.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. And that's actually a great lead in to my next question, because I saw that you visited other areas. Obviously you live in a beautiful area, obviously, and there are great subjects that are probably never ending and you know, always changing throughout the seasons. But so you visited Denali and then Alaska. Were those dedicated photography trips for you?
Absolutely. Or? Yeah. Okay. I left in mid-July this year and drove up to Alaska. And I spent the entire summer and fall up there. I got back in early October.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, and I wanted to do it, you know, I wanted to drive it so I could see all the stuff along the way, especially in the Yukon and far northern British Columbia. And it was just lovely. You know, the whole point of the trip was photography. So I shot almost 600 sheets of 4x5 film.
Oh, wonderful.
Over 2.5 months. And I'm still working on developing. I got about 80 more sheets to develop. So
did you... It's maybe a very technical question, but did you then actually develop while you were traveling, or
No, I just stashed it. I just had it all in boxes under the bed of the van. Yeah.
Okay. Oh yeah. And so, you know, when traveling with film equipment, which used to be commonplace, right, nowadays it seems to be getting a little more challenging potentially as the security equipment at airports has changed. And, you know, I understand, for example, you don't want to check film, unexposed film or even exposed film because they blast it with too much, energy. But, do you have some, you know, for those of us who are interested or actually doing film photography, what are some of your learnings or tips for doing that, to successfully do it without having a catastrophe happen?
Oddly enough, I actually haven't flown with film. I haven't flown since 2019, so it's been a little while. I do a lot of road trips, but you really, these days, especially because a lot of airports have added the CT scanners even for your hand baggage, And those can apparently, I mean, I've heard some people have managed to get through, but for the most part, they destroy film immediately.
Yep.
So, and that's even the hand check stations. And not, I don't think all airports have them yet, but they're pretty common now.
Okay.
And so you really do need to request a hand check, which is a challenge. It's annoying. You should be able to find the security person or the security person's manager that should be able to get the hand check done for you. That's what I had. When I my last trip was to Scotland in 2019, and I was actually using roll film for that trip, and that was not a problem to get a hand check, especially rolls. Boxes are a little more annoying. They don't love boxes that have been opened, you know, because you have to open them and you have to put your exposed film in there, and you know, you probably have numbers scratched on the box for the number of sheets you have in there. And I have some labels on my website you can print out that look kind of official. You know, you can like you know, do not open, do not X-ray film inside, you know, you know, that's something that you could try that. But you should really be able to find the manager that will hand check for them without opening the boxes. So, And I'd always have your changing bag with you if you shoot sheet film, because if they really want to be crazy about it, they can stick their hands in the changing bag and open the boxes.
They could actually.
I think that's incredibly unlikely, but, you know, have that stuff with you.
But yeah, you have to be, but it sounds like you have to be kind of, well, first of all, ask for the hand check, but then also be prepared to maybe even take a little extra time if there might be some some complications.
Yeah, you might find you know, a younger TSA agent that does not even know what you're talking about or something, and doesn't want to deal with film. So you gotta allow some time to get to the manager or, you know, escalate it if you need to. But definitely don't check it. They'll blast you with x-rays. So
right.
Yeah.
So would you, I mean, specifically to your work, you obviously primarily work with the large format, the 4x. Would you typically, I mean, would you still travel, air travel with
sure
form?
I just tend to take most of my trips by vehicle, because I've got, you know, I can sleep in my van, and it's just a nice way.
We got
a huge country to get around, so it works pretty well. So
there are plenty of soft checks around.
Yeah.
that's true. So the way I discovered actually you and your work was through many of the educational resources you have provided on your website, and they're great. And of course, we'll link to that in the show notes as well. Many of them are free, but you have also, you have some great eBooks as well. Yeah. And so I was just kind of curious if you could talk a little bit more about that, and maybe what motivates you to kind of share that great knowledge.
I'd say, like, first off, it was even like back in the Flickr days when that was pretty popular. You know, I was just getting a lot of questions from people about how I, you know, make such exposures or whatever. And so I figured I'd start kind of helping people out by writing these blog posts, you know, especially because I was still kind of learning on my journey as well, but it seemed as people were looking to my information as useful. So I was writing about my experiences, what's worked for me, and hoping it would help others. And it's just kind of grown from there. And it seems to be quite helpful for those starting off in film, or even people with some experience in it as well.
I tend to agree. I mean, I'm actually just getting myself a little bit started into 4x5 photography, and so I've read quite a few of your blog posts and helpful, and even one of your ebooks that was super helpful as well. So, yeah, and one maybe related question on that: Are you doing any workshops for in large format photography?
What I offer is if people want to do like a one-on-one session, I have done that with people in the past. So, you know, I haven't done like a group workshop where I have, you know, 5-6 people wandering around. I just kind of like that one-on-one. It's worked pretty well. So, you know, usually, you know, a few, 2, 3, or 4 days or something like that with a client. So,
Got it. That's cool. So I guess, so I live in Minnesota, a place that tends to get quite cold in the winter.
Oh, yeah.
and I'm just kind of curious, you know, that maybe apply to even some of the digital photography as well, but I'm kind of curious about, you know, when you're photographing in the winter, which is clearly a beautiful time to be out as well, how is your workflow maybe different, or what are some of the things you're kind of, you know, with all your experience that you've learned that you could maybe share?
Right. I mean, you know, luckily all of the film gear works just fine in the cold. So, I mean, that's okay. Just keeping your hands warm. That's the only problem. Yeah. This is like no such thing as a proper pair of gloves for a photographer, I feel like. So,
That's true.
Something that you can manipulate the camera with, but isn't, too cold either. So, mostly the... I'd say main thing is, the large format, probably the biggest challenge is breathing on the camera and making it super foggy. I had a client with me one time and he had one of those like fancy, I think you see them on Instagram, like Wanderer dark cloths or something like that. They look cool. They're heavy cotton. They're, nice dark cloth, I guess. They're not good when it's cool out because it's just this wet cotton rag that you're breathing into essentially. His ground glass immediately iced over and we couldn't do anything. You couldn't see anything on the camera at all. You couldn't focus. Cause it was about like, I think it was 10 degrees Fahrenheit out or so. It was pretty chilly. We're in the desert. It was a dry desert. We were in Utah. But just from breathing on the thing and under that dark cloth, it just was immediately fogged up. So, just a lightweight, like synthetic, polyester type material, dark cloth will do the trick there. And then just, I try to actively hold my breath under the camera and breathe elsewhere. The whole Alaska trip, even though it wasn't extremely cold for the most part, the humidity was just always, it wasn't warm. It was in the 40s or 50s and it was as humid as the year could possibly be. And, just my body being near the camera would make the lens fog up. It seemed like constant challenge. There's a lot of glass surfaces and a lot of air moving around inside such a large camera, it seems like. So like that was quite a problem. I even held my stove under the lens one time to defog it quickly, and so.
Thanks for sharing that. I tend to agree as well with what she said about the gloves. I mean, you can try to layer and all this, but it's still really hard
thing I've found for gloves seems to be like one of those wool, like thin wool base, liner glove. They actually keep you fairly warm and they even kind of work if you get a little sweaty. But they don't last long. That's my problem. I can bust through two pairs of those in a winter and they're not like $40 a pair. And I'm like, what's going on? Yeah. It's kind of expensive glove budget. So,
right.
So,
we already spoke a little bit about your travels. Do you have, and obviously you just mentioned you came back, from a trip to Alaska. Do you have any other travels planned?
Nothing huge on the horizon right now. I'm finishing up my Alaska film. I'll probably do, usually I get a little antsy in the winter and want to warm up somewhere, so I'll probably go to California for a couple weeks sometime in the winter.
Okay.
Like Death Valley and such. Usually I do something like that, and then I'll probably start planning summer trips next year. I think next year I actually want to focus pretty hard on my home state because I kind of neglected it this year. Going up in Alaska, and I think that like a whole month off, it was nice to take 2.5 months on the road, like not even going home at all. It was pretty amazing. So I think I'd like to do something where I spend about a month just driving around Colorado and doing as much kind of extended backpacking trips throughout our mountains as we can, as possible. So,
lots to see
there. So,
wonderful. So I want to talk a little bit about, the creative process, your creative process. How do you plan for your outings? I mean, obviously now you've been doing this for a while and you kind of know many spots probably, but are you, Ansel Adams, right, was big into the pre-visualization and all that, but is that something, are you even doing that? Is that something that, or are you more in the moment? Because my guess is, and the reason why I'm especially curious with, with large format, that it's not like, I guess you could set up relatively quickly and, if you're experienced, it's probably not, people always say it's slow. Well, maybe it's not that slow, but it's not point and shoot, right?
Right.
We can agree on that. So just kind of curious, what's your, when you go out and maybe when it's local somewhere, do you have some specific already shots in mind that you're kind of trying to get, or is it just you kind of go by more with the flow.
Yeah, I'd say for a large format shooter, I'm a little more from the hip than most are. So I do kind of, I kind of do live in the moment a bit, though. You know, especially in my local area, there's just, you know, roads I've driven down or biked down or wandered around over the years. And I kind of have some go-to subjects, some things that I know in the area. But when it comes to like a new area, you know, sure, you can do a little research on an area and you can kind of find some good scenes. But honestly, I have a lot of trouble shooting anywhere where there might be a crowd. It's just you pull out a 4x5 camera and you're going to get all sorts of nonsense questions and people in your face. So I really don't deal well with other people around or touristy areas. Yeah. So my goal is to, you know, so anything you can see online as far as research is going to have, you know, obviously if there's information about it online, it's probably popular. There's
a lot of people.
Right. So I get an idea about a general region from that kind of research. And then I kind of figure out, you know, I can search topo maps. I can try to find some either trails or off trail areas that are a little more remote to get an idea of what might look interesting. Sometimes you might find a blog from a backpacker, you know, some ultra backpacker who just brought a cell phone back there and has a, you know, you get an idea of what the landscape may look like from the ground. Yeah. But it's not necessarily a busy area. And so you can find out that kind of research, but a lot of times I don't really know what I'm getting into until my boots are on the ground. So, so, you know, usually you can almost, you get yourself in a really beautiful mountain valley, I'll find something to shoot. So, I can figure it out. It'll work pretty well. Yeah. So, yeah. So there's a little bit of research like that. And then a lot of it's just once I get there.
Yeah. That makes sense. And I noticed too, when visiting, you know, national parks, as if you want to lose the crowds, just go hike a little bit.
It's
pretty easy.
Yep.
And speaking of, Death Valley is a place I've visited many, many years ago, before I was deep into photography again, I should say. But anyway, I'm curious. So when you go there, is it, are there still spots where you can just kind of, because it seems like, you know, if depending on the season, it probably is still quite busy and there are certain spots.
Winter is their still busy season and it's gotten to become a rather popular photo destination. Okay. And there's a ton of workshops going on there. That seems to be
right.
I mean, you're not going to go. I mean, it seems like everyone's trying to make a few dollars during their slow winter season. So all these photographers, you know, have these 12 person groups wandering around the desert. And it's actually become quite a spectacle because, I mean, what an odd place to become a ultra popular workshop destination. You know, it's just, you know, we're all shooting mud cracks in the dirt. It's kind of fascinating. what a world. But yeah, so you're going to see those. Most workshop clients aren't camping in vans, you know, 3-hour drive from the resort. So they're probably going to be not all that far from the resort parts of the park, you know, where there's actually lodging because there's a couple of hotels inside the park. So they're probably going to be within an hour drive of there. So Badwater Basin is pretty busy at sunrise and sunset. And so are the Mesquite Dunes, the ones that are right off the road there. But the backcountry is pretty quiet actually. So you can drive to some of the much more remote parts of the park, so long as you're willing to camp. And then some of the dune fields take a, you know, 2 to 4 mile hike in and walking on sand for 4 miles isn't particularly easy. So it's going to be pretty quiet. So,
So there are definitely still some hikeable areas. It sounds
absolutely.
Like. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, a different question about the creative process, but you know, you've been obviously focusing on landscape for a long time now. Do you ever deal with kind of a lack of inspiration or what people like to refer to as creative block, or do you ever experience that?
I mean, there's times where maybe I'm a little less inspired to shoot than others. Not necessarily. It's probably because I'm just working on other projects, you know, the kind of the other sides of the business or something like that. You know, usually if I'm feeling a little bit like, man, I've just shot the same things over and over, I just go out more. I'll find something different. So I'm usually pretty steady on inspiration. Yep. So I kind of have my ideas of what I want. And for the most part, I kind of keep going at it. So I'd recommend just keep trying. You'll probably, find the same subjects. I really did take a twist on my prairie work a few years ago, started really introducing even more of that human element, and it kind of got more interesting to me again. And I started taking trips even further out, even up to Montana and stuff like that, to get a different flavor of the prairie. Yep. And it actually works really well for me. And as you get out there, you just see more and more. So I just kind of recommend just keep trying, because look at the same things in everywhere. Because it ended up being these kind of buildings I'd driven by for 10 years. I'm like, you know what? Those are actually kind of interesting if I compose them this way. And instead of shooting with a wide like I normally had, I started shooting with a longer lens, and it just totally changed the compositions. And I'm like, this is fascinating. So I just kind of kept working at it. So
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, that's a great, I think, just what you mentioned about, you know, just keep going, right? And just go out and do it, even though you may not feel inspired. I like what you said too about going back to the same places, something actually I tend to do. And I find, you know, it seems like it may seem boring to some extent, but it really isn't.
Right. There's some subjects I've shot so many times, and, you know, it's like the eighth time where I finally get the photo I like out of it. And, or even I just stand a little differently, or maybe the clouds were different or something. I'm like, oh, this is a fun way to compose this subject. I have never done it that way. So, you know, just walk around it differently and think about it. So, right. There's options.
Right. And so for your work in the prairies, is that a mix of, I assume it's also drivable, obviously, but then is that you have to hike a lot
well, a lot of the stuff with man-made structures in it is, I'm from the road. I'm not really hopping fences and trespassing or anything.
I'm pretty
much right from the road.
And
that's kind of what changing to a longer lens kind of gave me, gave me a little more reach to make the subjects interesting and just change the way I compose them. So it's actually worked pretty well. So
Okay. I'd like to talk a little bit about your panorama work. Maybe a little bit more technical question, but I'm just curious how you went about creating the panoramic images.
I just decided to choose the simplest method, which is shoot a full sheet of 4x5 film and crop it. So I did no extra gear to carry, no weird roll film holders, and it's also the most flexible. I was getting really into panoramas, and I ended up buying a 6x17 camera, which is really a large format camera with a, you know, 6x17 roll film back shoved on it, is really all those are. They're pretty primitive cameras. And you know, it is a fun camera to use. A little bit quicker than 4x5 because there's no ground glass to mess with. I mean, you're just you're just guessing the focus and shooting shots pretty quickly. But right quickly, I found the limitations of that panoramic format. That 1x3 was too narrow for a lot of prints. A lot of customers were like, that's cool in a 20x60, but can I get a 30x60? And I'd be like, no, actually. So there's nothing there. So I pretty quickly shelved that camera and went right back to shooting 4x5, which is great because I have my whole range of lenses. I mean, that one, the panoramic camera, that was a fixed lens camera. So a fairly wide angle.
Yeah.
And It just crop the half sheet. It's just that easy. You can look at the grid, and I can count five little grid lines. That's the panorama right there. So it's just half a sheet is what I do. You could choose 1x3, but I do that 2x5 ratio. It just looks really, really good to me. It's a little fatter than that 1x3, and it just looks good in a print.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Oh, yeah, that's cool. That's actually fairly, I didn't know that it was that straightforward, but.
Yeah, and then, you know, a lot of people want to talk about, like, you know, you can use one of those half dark slides where you can use half the sheet and then you can flip it around and use the other half for another panorama. And I just see a nightmare of confusion happening there. Yeah. And there's no way you're going to take like a 3-month trip and not mess up some of those panoramas. I just, that's a lot of, especially I'm kind of in a rush sometimes as the light is changing and I'm just, you know, shooting sheets. So I'd rather not mess with that kind of labeling system. And again, I want that print flexibility. I might like it as a panorama. And there's so many times where I really intended it to be a panorama. I get the full sheet and I'm like, you know what? That's pretty cool. It's a 4x5. So I'm glad I shot a whole sheet. So yeah, it's the easiest method. No gear required. It's a little wasteful on film, according to some people. And that really, some people get a little upset about wasting film, but I don't think it's a waste because of all the surprises where I end up liking the whole sheet.
But then do you almost then double compose in a way? So do you really, I mean, you compose for the panorama when you're doing it, but do you also kind of think about how it could look as a
Absolutely. I'm not always just sticking the pano portion dead in the middle. You know, I'm quite often being like, well, this is good as the pano, but you know, it would look a little bit better if the horizon were on that top third or bottom third. So I am considering the whole sheet as well.
That's cool. Well, so one thing I noticed, and I briefly, I think, mentioned it already, is that you are offering drum scanning services for other film photographers. So I want to maybe talk a little bit about that.
if you
wouldn't mind.
About like, I guess about six years ago or so, I got that drum scanner. It's a 500 plus pound scanner. So I have to fluid mount the film, which that in itself kind of, it eliminates a lot of the dust and scratches and is a really good way to mount. So you mount it to the drum with a fluid, and it just uses a different type of sensor. It uses tubes instead of, you know, a CCD or CMOS sensor. So it's kind of a mostly analog process until it gets converted to a digital file at the end. And it's just a really good way to get extra dynamic range out of your slides. You can get a lot of shadow detail out of slides, and you get really good tonality on both slides and negatives. I mean, smooth gradients, you know, I have it fully color profiled, so slides look exactly as they do on a light table when they get scanned in. So it's just a great way to go. So I offer that to people.
Is it especially good for slides, or would you say it doesn't? I mean, it's obviously
it's great for both. Yeah. For
color negative as well.
I think a lot of people may notice benefits from slides even more, just because the way you can get that extra shadow detail. I mean, you shouldn't just send, you know, frames that are completely underexposed, but it's amazing what you can actually salvage from a slide. You know, you can get a couple, you can get a stop or more of shadow detail out of those. So, you know, with that, like a flatbed scanner couldn't see anything, and sometimes this can really pick it up. So, but I think the smooth gradients is a great thing for the negatives too. I mean, just having that, no banding, just really good tonality. So I have to fully manually invert the negatives myself, because the scanner software is pretty lousy. So, because it's a pretty old software, so I have to just scan it in as a raw negative, and then manually invert it. So
do you eventually then bring those files into Lightroom or Photoshop?
Photoshop is where I do it.
That can handle the size, I presume, as well.
Yeah, right? I think Lightroom can as well. I've just never really messed with Lightroom much, so
I know you, I'm sure you're getting a lot of questions from people interested in large format photography. And we discussed already, right? You provide some free resources. There's the blog, there's your website, you have some great ebooks. And I'm just kind of curious, what are some of the common questions you are getting from people, if you don't mind sharing some of your wisdom about this, and kind of, you know, if people who are interested in getting into it, what are some of the
it's kind of interesting how questions ebb and flow. I mean, there was a year where everyone was asking me about loops. I don't know why loops were on everyone's mind, but everyone seemed to care about what kind of loop I use. And I literally found someone that some friend found in a garbage bin full of photo gear that someone gave him in town. I mean, it's like, it's got to be a $5 loop. it really doesn't matter what loop you use, as long as it magnifies the ground glass. I think you should look for something between 5 and 10x magnification. Yep. But like, and then someone had this like $400 Schneider loop, and you know, I put it against the ground glass, and I'm like, yeah, it looks about the same. So, but it weighs it weighs a pound, so I don't know why I'd want to carry that everywhere. So. Yep. So I don't know, but the loop question kind of died down last year. So I don't know. That was a hot question for a while. People ask about panoramas a lot, so it's kind of good.
Okay. So that's a stone.
Yeah. And then generally a lot of people just want to know what brand of gear to buy. And I avoid that question. You can see my, you know, I have a blog post about how to choose lenses and a camera. Yep. And I give you all of the things you might want to look for. But I don't really just tell you to buy this brand of this lens and this model, because I think we should all make our own educated choice based off our own desires. And also the brand name just doesn't matter a whole lot with these lenses, particularly. I mean, as long as you buy from one of the main manufacturers, you know, Shiner, Rodensack, there's even some great Kodak lenses and Nikon lenses. So there's all Fuji. I mean, there's just tons. All of them are great. I mean, you're going to be excellent lenses. Some of them kind of have their own specialties. You know, Nikon might make one that's a real compact long lens or something like that for backpacking, and others might make a more coverage lens. But I think if you understand what you're looking for, then you'll realize, you know, you're not just choosing based off of someone's brand and model recommendation, which I think is something we see a lot in the digital camera world.
Oh yeah.
And I just really would like to avoid that when I give advice, because I just don't think it's that important.
Would you say obviously money is can be an issue, right?
Sure.
for in photography or else or in other areas, of course. But where is the really the expense in the end when you're getting into large format? Is it going to be ultimately in the film itself?
For me, my top two expenses are film and gas.
Okay.
So yeah, okay. Those are my top two expenses.
Okay.
And I'd say my trip to Alaska and back, I think they're pretty close. I think gas won out by about like 20%. But yeah, so film and gas were pretty close. And I'd say that's pretty similar on most of my trips, unless I'm shooting super locally.
Yeah.
Film is going to be expensive one. I usually shoot this year. I shot a lot more, but I generally shoot about 600 sheets of film in a year. Okay. And it's $6 a shot. So, that right there is enough to buy you a full kit of the gear for the most part. You could buy several lenses and a large format camera for just what I spend in film every year. Now, if you're only going to shoot a couple of boxes every year, then the camera might be your main expense or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it kind of depends on how much you use it.
And is there a big difference between color and black and white?
And white's like a quarter of the price usually. Okay. So I know when I was shooting it was closer to $1 a sheet, and I think it's more like $1.50 now, but
okay,
you know, it's a lot. And developing, you could do it a lot easier yourself.
You can do it easily at home, right?
Color is actually no harder to develop than black and white, aside from the temperature control. You just need to find some method of keeping the temperature up, and you can do that with a water bath in your sink or a fancy machine, whatever you want. They're both pretty easy to develop, but the black and white chemistry is even cheaper and really available. Yeah. You can pretty much make it yourself if you wanted to. So
maybe a little more forgiving, right? Overall.
Is
that the fair statement?
Yeah. I mean, you just develop it at room temperature, and there's longer developing times, which kind of make for less mistakes.
You have
to. C41 is the hardest to develop.
Color you have to be very right on, right? With the temperature and the time.
Yeah. Slides are actually really easy because that first developer time is pretty long. It's almost 7 minutes, but. With C41, that first developer is 3 minutes, 15 seconds, and any variation in the amount of time it takes chemistry to get from one part of the sheet to another, you know, pretty massively can result in like, you know, streaks or uneven developing. So C41 is the one where temperature and even, you know, all the chemistry has to hit the film at once, you know, immediately. So that's kind of the challenge with C41.
Cool. Well, good. Well, I think before we wrap up, just one hopefully simple, very simple question. Where can people best find you?
You can find me on Instagram at Alex Burke Photo or my website, which is alexburkephoto.com.
Okay.
And there's lots of, you know, like you said, free information on there. Yep. So I have the whole, it's just a section called Learn, and that's got my educational blog posts. You can find all that stuff there.
Wonderful. And we'll link to that in the show notes as well. So, well, great. Well, Alex, I really appreciated your time and learning from your great experience in large format photography. And thanks again.
Yeah, you bet. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You can find links to Alex's website in the show notes. Thanks so much for listening, and talk to you next time.